Page Fright is recorded on the traditional unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples.
Back to Page Fright. My name is Andrew French. I'm formerly an artist known as on Twitter at the Andrew French. I guess the account's still up on X. I haven't really used it much. I'll probably put this episode out there. But from now on, I think what I should do is plug the Instagram. So on Instagram, we're at Page Fright Pod. And if you want to follow me personally, I'm at It's Andrew French. So you can check that out. And this, of course, is the world's first podcast, the only podcast out there that I host. I am thrilled to have you back for another episode. And of course, you're noticing probably when you're listening to this, I mean, just chances are it's September. But this is our August episode. And I'm sitting down yet again, folks, in front of my computer, having recorded this interview with our fantastic guest 3 weeks ago, and putting off editing and putting off recording the intros, because there's always time for that later, until there's not. And it's August 31st today, folks. It's 10:29 a.m. in Vancouver. I'm sitting down with my coffee starting the day. I guess I'm kind of in the middle of the day. And it's the last day of August. And here's our August episode coming out on the last day again. So I apologize to you for making you wait. Apologize to our guests for making them wait, because, you know, I could have had this out like 2 weeks ago and I just didn't get around to it. So here we are on the 31st, and folks, there's no better day to be sitting down recording an intro for you. I'm thrilled to talk about today's episode a little bit before we jump in, because I want to mention, and I don't know how much of this came across, I didn't have a ton of time outside of the recording to chat with Brandy. I kind of Brandy Bird is our guest today, just spoiled it, but we'll get to their bio here in a second. I didn't have a ton of time to chat with Brandy outside of the actual recording. That's on my end. I had to run like right after, but one thing I don't know that I got to tell them, other than, you know, I think I said, like, I've seen you around at some writing events and stuff, which is a very dulled down way of saying I've actually been a fan of Brandy's work for a decent amount of time. For me, most of my amount of time as a writer in Vancouver, the first event I went to, as a Vancouver, I don't know, writer, a person back in Vancouver trying to write after I moved to Ontario, was a launch party for Rahilla's Ghost, who put out some fantastic chapbooks. I think we shout them out in this episode. Again, it's been a couple weeks, but fantastic, fantastic chapbooks from them. And an event that really inspired me to get involved in the writing community and actually to start up this podcast. So I went to a launch for Jessica Johns and Eslyn McPhee's chapbooks. I believe there were other readers too, and I believe, I could be making this up in my head, but I heard of Brandy there, or I saw Brandy read there. And I remember being like, oh, this is fantastic writing. And just being so blown away by their work the first time I heard them read. I'm trying to place where the heck I heard them read the first time, but I've seen them read before, and just being blown away. So I'm thrilled that I've got them now as a guest in the catalog of Page Fright episodes. It only took me 80 something, but here we are today again, August 31st, last day of August, and I can say this writer who I've been following for a while now has their debut collection out, and it's fantastic. It's called The All Plus Flesh. I asked them in the interview, how the heck do I say this, because I'm not sure. Some people use like a plus symbol as shorthand for and so we clarified. It's The All Plus Flesh, if you're reading this at home and you didn't know. That's what it is. It's out now with House of Anansi, and it's fantastic. Now, one thing I need to say. I brought her up a lot, and I use this intentionally in the interview. I like to connect people that I'm reading with people that I'm speaking to, and really just people I'm reading with each other. So Brandy, I was connecting their work to Mary Oliver, her work, pretty frequently in the interview. And I just need you to know that I listen. I love Mary Oliver, and whether or not it's an appropriate pairing, whether or not, like, I think there's going to be more writers that are more like Brandy than Mary Oliver. They write pretty different styles of poetry, but there's a lot of overlap in terms of, just having a poetic conversation about Brandy's work. Mary Oliver came up quite a bit, so just want to throw that out there. And if you've been following me on Instagram, you'll know that I've been reading a heck of a lot of Mary Oliver. Still working my way through the collected that it's taken me years to get to, despite having read many of the books that are in there. Anyway, this is a general ad to say you should read Mary Oliver. You should also read The All Plus Flesh by Brandy Bird, which is out now with House of Anansi. And as the subject of today's episode, okay, I am rambling, folks. And it's time, I think, we get you to the good stuff, the interview. Nobody's here to listen to me. We're here to listen to Brandy and their fantastic answers. So, Brandy Bird is an Indigiqueer, Salto, Cree, and Métis writer and editor from Treaty One territory. They currently live and learn on the land of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam peoples. Bird's poems have been published in Catapult, The Puritan, Room Magazine, and others. They are a fourth-year BFA student at the University of British Columbia, but their heart is always yearning for the prairies. Without further ado, here I am chatting with Brandy Bird. Episode 81, I think, of Page Fright, and I am excited to talk to somebody who I think the poetry community has been excited about hearing from in book form for quite a while. And I am a member of that group. I am so excited to talk about this book. Brandy Bird is here. Brandy, how's it going?
It's going great.
Great. Okay. I mean, I love that. It's good to hear things are good. You have a new book out with House of Anansi. It's called The All Plus Flesh. Now, this is something that I have to address right up front before we even get into the reading, which we'll do soon. Is it all plus flesh or the all and flesh? Like, how are you pronouncing this?
I'm pronouncing it the all plus flesh, but
Okay.
it I'm open to any spins on the title.
Cool. Okay. I love that. Awesome. Okay. So the all plus flesh, it is literally the plus symbol if you haven't read it yet or looked at it yet. So that's why I am clarifying for listeners. But this is out with House of Anansi. It's an awesome book. I'm super excited to talk about the poems in here, and writing beyond that with you. But before we get to that, if there are listeners who do not know what your work is like, could I get you to read a poem for us to get acquainted?
For sure. I'm going to read a poem called Relocation, which is about my family's forced relocation from East Selkirk to Pegwiss First Nation, which is a reserve in Manitoba. East Selkirk is a place in Manitoba that's about an hour away from Winnipeg, the biggest city in Manitoba. Yeah, this is called Relocation. And it's a super skinny poem, which I don't usually write. It's like it's a very slim column. Skinny lady, okay, relocation. Ended is a name I've given my body. Myself, a church I built with blueprints stolen from Lower Fort Garry. 1907, the concept, a calendar dredged up from a well in the flood of the century. North is displacement, the forced removal, 169 kilometers up the prairie. An organized body, a body on asphalt, asphalt and gravel roads. Here, there is only the sound of footsteps and rain. All Indians are rivers, live in the river, die there. Their bodies float to Hudson's Bay, get caught as the river freezes, reanimate, talk dirty to each other. Pegwiss First Nation, illegal land transfer, molted air from the chimney stack that grows out of Selkirk, Manitoba. Anxiety is summer, is a natural gas thermal pump and a little girl beside it in 2002. She sleeps with a knife under her pillow, a screwdriver once her mother hides the knives. Gets her hair cut for $5 at the local barber shop when she gets lice. Relocated. In wagons, in cars, by foot, ticks in armpits and pubic hair. Tall grasses, tall grasses. There are telephone poles that link the whole town to the city, to the country. A country grows out of a girl's back, and she has never known the reserve. Permits to leave, her grandmother married on Broken Head Ojibwe Nation at 13, children after child after children, herself like fresh flint never struck. great-great-grandma tilled fields, grew carrots, dreamed of owning property, ownership, owning. Her sons went to war and one came back blind. He dug his hands into the earth. He dug his hands into the earth.
Amazing. Thank you for opening with this poem. It was one of the ones that I had flagged as a favorite from the book. This happens all the time on the show, which just tells me that I am maybe on the right track in terms of the poems I like, because they seem to be what the authors like too. So I'm very proud of that. But I really like this poem. And you mentioned off the top that it was a skinnier poem. They're short lines. And so as opposed to jumping into the content of the poem, which we will do, we'll talk about the themes in this book extensively today. But I really, really, really wanted to talk a little bit about form, because Brandy, I'll admit right off the bat, I am scared of changing the form of my poems. I'm scared of losing the margin. And when I read books like yours that are experimenting with form and the size of lines, the position of lines on the page, and all of these things, and still delivering a really, really impactful poem, I'm always blown away. So I wanted to ask for you, let's say with a poem like this, how do you kind of know what form you want to put the poem in, where the line's going to end? Like, how do you sort of figure that out?
This poem was sort of inspired by Katarina Vermette's River Woman. The form that she uses in that book, the like short lines often. And I think I did that because it is a river poem. And I feel like even though like everything is like about the relocation of my family, it's still very connected to the Red River specifically, which is a winding river in Manitoba that I'm very connected to. Like, my grandparents had land right in East Selkirk on the river, and I grew up there for the first like five or six years of my life, visiting all the time, sometimes staying there for more extended periods of time. And I just wanted to honor that. And I think with my form, my use of form in this book, I have a lot of swoopy poems that like are almost like, they're angular. Sorry, my cat just jumped on the bed. Oh, this is a big thump. So there's a lot of like, movement in the work, which I think is necessary for my poetry because it's like narrative. I was realizing this as I was trying to choose a broadside for Anansi, that a lot of my work I feel can't be cut out and decontextualized. I think my work is heavily based in storytelling, which I was sort of like resentful of at first when I first started writing poetry. I was like, I just want to write things that are not related always to story. I want to write something that's more, what is the word that I'm trying to use?
Like abstract sort of thing, or like, yeah.
Something more abstract, something more outside of myself. But it's just not something that's coming. So I'm just having to write through this. And I think form helps with that, is like, takes me in a little bit of a, it weirds the work versus like just having a, say, a column, a stanza of like 4 or 5 lines. And that's how I'm dealing with my lack of ability to write something a little bit more abstract.
Gotcha. So it's kind of a way to mix things up outside of like a narrative form. So you're maybe, I'm guessing at then the process maybe, similar to the one that I've used multiple times when I'm trying to recreate a poem, like some of these ones in your book, where, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, but where I'll sit down and I'll write like a narrative poem in the way that I'm comfortable with, which is often, you know, left aligned, like straightforward narrative poetry, and then play with the lines and see what positioning can do to change the meaning of the poem and that sort of thing. Is that sort of what you're going through?
Yeah, I want to see how it works with the meaning of the poem. And right now I'm relying really heavily on like this sort of swoopy style, and I want to get out of that too. Like, I want to do something even weirder, but like that entails using like Adobe, and I don't have Adobe, but like a Microsoft Word is awful for like formatting.
Yes.
And so like even formatting my book, like the title titular poem of the book, The All Plus Flesh, we struggled a lot with trying to align the jagged angle that it's at, sort of at. It's like a pierced poem. It's like a poem that's like an arrow. It looks like a piercing, and or a puncture. And we had a hell of a time with that poem.
You know, I feel your pain a little bit. I think a lot of people who maybe aren't writing but are reading poetry, and by the way, there's only a couple of them, but the ones that are out there might not realize that Microsoft Word is sort of, it seems, the chosen medium for most poets, and that it can be really difficult to kind of mix up language and positioning of things in Microsoft Word. Like, it's really hard to make things a fun form. I wrote a poem in my first chapbook that's shaped like a wave, and I gotta tell you, the table I built to put the words into the shape of a wave in Microsoft Word, I'm so proud of that thing. Not because I think it's a good poem, but just because I've never made such a complicated table in my whole life. But yeah, so okay, and you mentioned the All Plus Flesh, which I want to talk a little bit about. This poem and the title of your book in general, because something that's really important to this book, as the title somewhat suggests, is the body. And you talk a lot about illness, about like relocation, like we just did in that first poem, and how the body moves through space, is affected by things. And then there is the beyond the body, which I see as an interpretation of your title as being the all. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about this, how you see the body as playing into your work, both in this book and maybe beyond.
Yeah, so I'm diabetic. I have a poem in the book called Ode to Diabetes. It's sort of it's a weird one in that I talk about like drinking holy water from a basin that babies are going to be baptized in. Yeah, like I don't know, it's a weird poem, but so because I'm diabetic and because I'm Indigenous, there's a lot of like stigma that comes with that, and I wanted to write not to the stigma or around the stigma, but more just like through it, I guess. And so like the book is the title is The All Plus Flesh, which just is the etymology, I believe is the right word and not entomology, of pancreas, pan and creas. And that is the organ in my body that doesn't work. And so I've been on like many medications. I've seen many, many doctors. I've got like secondary conditions from the diabetes, and it's brought me a lot of pain, psychological pain, emotional pain, physical pain. And I hadn't seen that reflected in like Indigenous literature anyways, even though I know a lot of Indigenous people who have chronic illnesses. So I wanted to write towards that, and talk about the body and beyond the body, which is I'm not a spiritual person, but I do believe that there is something that holds me together that maybe I don't understand. And so I wanted to write about that as well.
I think that's a really good, what you just described is a very good way of articulating how I've been feeling recently in terms of, I don't align myself particularly with a religion or anything, and I wouldn't really call myself super spiritual, but I've been thinking a lot lately about the external things beyond myself and the things within myself that are not the tangible and all that. And that was one of the things that I really enjoyed reading through in this book, was the sense in which, you know, you yourself can be at battle with your own body. You can have a very complicated relationship with your own body as you go through things like diabetes or other illnesses. It's something that I've been trying to tune into a lot in my own poetry, I guess. But I've been reading, if you follow me on Instagram, you'll know I've been reading a lot of Mary Oliver. And Mary Oliver is, again, I don't think necessarily particularly aligned with a specific religion, but very much a spiritual, just in awe of the world person. And so
Brandy, when I was reading your book, I was simultaneously reading Mary Oliver. I think it's Devotions is her collected. I finally am reading that. I was outraged to find out she has a whole book of dog poems that I didn't know about, and so I ordered that immediately, and like blah blah blah. So I'm obsessed with Mary Oliver. I've been reading her in addition to your book. And it's a weird, I think, connection to draw. I don't know that you probably came into this interview being like, well, Andrew's going to connect my work to Mary Oliver. But I gotta say, like, there were some parallels. And between the two of you, I've been thinking a lot about this sort of thing. I guess what this leads me to ask you is kind of like, what is there anybody that you've been reading that influenced either your sort of interpretation of that spiritual side of things, or is there anybody just in general that you've read that has really influenced this particular book?
Well, there's two people. So when I was 17, I wasn't writing really. I stopped writing when I was 14 or 15. I used to write lots of poetry. And I didn't pick it up again until I was 26. But randomly, I found out in Winnipeg that there was this Indigenous Writers Collective, and I dropped in for one meeting, and I wrote a terrible poem that probably worried everybody there. and Katarina Vermette was there, who I mentioned before. Yeah. And I listened to her free write, and I was like, wow, Indigenous people can write beautiful things, write beautiful poetry. And I hadn't read many Indigenous authors at that point. Like I was ignorant to it. Like I was a teenager, I was struggling a lot. I read a lot of like sad women poets, and like Sylvia Plath, for example, or like Anne Sexton, like they sort of informed how I felt about poetry, and I didn't feel like there was any room for me, an Indigenous person, in that world. And so she sort of exploded my mind. And since I was like 17, I was like, I want to start writing. I want to start writing. But it wasn't until I was 26 that, which is like, oh my gosh, that's like 6 years ago now, that I picked up a book by Liz Howard called Infinite Citizen of the Shaking Tent. Really like experienced what I thought poetry should be for me. Her work unsettled me in the best way. From that I got like it felt like nourishing, a nourishing work. And her second book too, Letters in a Bruised Cosmos, did the same thing, but because I had been, I could appreciate it even more because I know more about poetry now. Back then, when I was 26, I didn't know anything about poetry. I just knew that I loved what I was reading, and now I can see the mechanics of it in a way that I just didn't appreciate it before. And I feel like that is kind of spiritual to me, just having this like knowledge and being able to see. I don't claim to know any poem. Emily Riddle had a good tweet the other day, which said, basically said, when people call Indigenous people's work simple or plain spoken, they generally assume they can get everything they want from the poem by just reading it. But there's tons of things that go into poetry, especially Indigenous and works by Indigenous people, that people who are not Indigenous or not close to the person, or maybe not even maybe not anyone can understand outside of the work itself. So I think that though, like Liz Howard's work is so important to me because it's basically like my origin story. And I think that's really corny, but it's true.
Yeah, no, I've had similar experiences with other poets who I now look back on and I'm like, well, I don't really actually, there are poets, okay, who really inspired me to get into poetry. And I look back now and I'm like, I don't know that these are the poems that I'd be reading right now, but the role that they served at that point in my life was extremely influential. So they hold that point for me. And I think Liz Howard, obviously you would have a different relationship to, just because You know, I would still love to read Liz Howard. I think Liz Howard's writing is amazing. But the poets that I was reading were like classical poets, and now I'm like, I don't think that's really my vibe. But yeah, so okay, I've been asking some questions. They've been somewhat fumbled. I've gotta lean on my question for you, Brandy, from my last episode's guest. Cool. So Tom Cull, who is a fantastic poet based in London, Ontario, is wondering, does the poem have a responsibility outside of itself? What is it a responsibility to or to do? This is a really big question.
That is so a big
Yeah.
Next guest is not anything like that question.
Fantastic. No, I love that. I love that they can be so different. I think somebody asked on this show, and I could be wrong, but if I'm forgetting who it was, I'm sorry. They asked like what you had for breakfast or something like that. And that has always stuck with me as being a really fun question, because like, what does a poet eat for breakfast? This is a great question. But anyway, okay, your question, Brandy, to answer is, does the poem have a responsibility outside of itself? If so, what is it to or to do?
Well, I think for me, my poetry has a responsibility to my communities. Because like I have a responsibility to my communities, which are queer, Indigenous, disabled communities, specifically like for me, for my indigeneity, it's like Soto Cree and Métis. And I think that I don't know how, like, okay, in school, in university, I read this piece by Lee Markle about storytelling and how storytelling isn't necessarily all we need. And that's always stuck with me because, yeah, responsibility, like poetry has responsibility to, like I have a responsibility in my poetry to my community, but it's true that like poetry can't deliver a baby. Poetry can't do some of these really tangible things. It can do a lot, but it can't do these tangible things. Like she, in Lee Markle in the paper was talking about how, or not in the paper, in the chapter of her book, was talking, well, she actually misquoted Thomas King, which I think is really funny. saying that stories aren't all that we are. Arguing against Thomas King's claim that stories are all that we are, which I really have always thought about as a poet, because I don't want to have this romantic, this like romantic inclination and just leaving the poetry where it is. I want to make it a real thing in the world.
Interesting. So I really like what you're saying, because it's twofold, it seems. The sense in which poetry isn't everything, and you know, it can't do everything for us, especially the physical things, the tangible things. But at the same time, it serves some sort of purpose. And it's really interesting to think through this sort of thing. I mean, I often feel pressure when I sit down to write that, look, is probably my own problem that I need to work out in a space that isn't this podcast. But I often feel pressure to write something that is serving more of a purpose than just pointing something out. And often that can be what some of the best poetry does, is just the simple things that cause us to see things a different way. But even saying it like that, like that's such a massive task too. So it is really complicated, I think, and you've done a great job of it, to think through the idea of what a poem has a responsibility to. And I think the best thing to consider is exactly what you have, which is how our own poetry has a different responsibility maybe from another person's, and what that might look like. Specifically, you know, you mentioned being a member of multiple communities, as somebody who's just, I don't know if I can still say recently, but like semi-recently come out as non-binary, I feel a responsibility shift in my writing, that now instead of writing poems that were largely about masculinity, I'm writing poems that are questioning where those poems came from and how they might fit into an understanding of gender queering and this sort of thing. So you really do have to think about, I guess, your own poem's responsibilities more than anybody else's, you know? Like, I read your book, Brandy, and I read Mary Oliver at the same time, as I've told you. And I think your poems have a very different energy from Mary Oliver's energy, and that's because they need to. They have a responsibility to. And I just, yeah, it was so powerful to read your book. And I wanted to come back to something you mentioned earlier, which was that you took some time away from writing. There was a minute there in your life where you weren't writing. And this comes up in the book as well. And I read, I think, an interview where you mentioned this too, or an article or something. I was just scanning before we jumped on here. But I know there was a moment where you took time away. And I wanted to ask, what brought you back to writing? I mean, you gave us a bit of an insight there with the story of that writer's collective that you went to, but when you sat down, I guess, after that to write poetry again, what was that experience like, and what kept you coming back?
Well, so at age 26, after reading Infinite Citizen of the Shaking Tent, I was like, I'm going to go to some poetry readings. Mm. And I went to a few. I saw my very first week in Vancouver, I saw Selena Bowen and Sean Robinson read, I think, a Tonic series, which I don't think exists anymore, at the Drive Cafe bar, which I don't think exists anymore either. And I was like mesmerized by it. I thought these two writers were just like changing the world. Like, they broke open my brain. And I was like, one day I want to have a community like this. And now there are two of my really great friends, Sean and Selena, which is very weird to happen, but whatever. And I also went to a poetry reading in which only, there was only white writers reading. And I was like, oh, this is an interesting thing. I didn't think it bothered me in a way that I didn't understand, like, at the moment. And I was like, wait, I want to be up there. Like, I want to be up there disrupting this, this panel of only white writers. And so on the SkyTrain home to my dad's, where I was living at the time, just as like a temporary thing, he lived in Burnaby. So I had to take the Millennium line, and I just wrote a poem on the SkyTrain, and it was a terrible poem, but I actually published that. Like, I had that poem published in Event magazine for an essay I did on writer's block and fear, and because I feel like it was such a precious poem to me, like the very first thing I wrote. And after that, I had been expelled from McGill for not for anything cool, but for just like not going to class, withdrawing from classes a lot, like just being generally unwell. And I was taking time off, and I decided to go back to school, and I decided to go to Douglas because they had a really great creative writing program under Elizabeth Baczynski. And so I took that creative writing program classes for the creative writing program. I took a poetry class with Elizabeth, and I just started writing madly. Like, almost every day I would write a poem. And of course they weren't good poems, and I didn't know how to revise. I didn't know what enjambment was. I didn't know what form was. I was just taken by ideas. And And at the end of that class, Liz took me aside and said, I think you're a poet. Like, you need to do this. And ever since then, I was just like, wow, maybe I am a poet. And that's driven me a lot, is just the fact that, like, a writer is just someone who writes, and I'm a writer.
Yeah. Yeah, I had such an idea that in order to be a poet, you needed to be published somewhere before I was published anywhere. And then I was like, well, nothing's changed. So why did I ever believe that? I'm still struggling to get more published, and still having the same issues that I had before. So yeah, nothing changes. There's no need to publish things. You can call yourself a writer and be a writer at any point as long as you're writing. That's the beautiful thing.
Even if you're not writing, sometimes you can take a 2-year break. You can always come back if you have the words and they'll come.
Totally. And sometimes you need that space away from writing too. I feel like I've just come back recently, which is why I asked you this question. I took some time away, maybe a couple months, and I've come back and I'm working on things again. And it's really nice to be back, but I never stopped working in a way. Like I was never, just because I'm not typing letters on the keyboard into Word doesn't mean that I'm not doing the work of writing, because there's so much observation and perception that's a big part of it too.
One of the biggest part of writing, just to observe take in life.
And I think when you talk about a poem's responsibility, maybe that's a poet's responsibility to an extent too, is just to be that observer. I mean, that's something I really appreciated in your work. That's something I appreciate in Mary Oliver's work. I keep bringing these two back. I really don't mean to pair you with Mary Oliver exclusively. There are other poets. Oh, okay. I mean, then that's good. I'm happy to do that then. We're about halfway through. Maybe Brandy, I should get you to read another poem for us.
For sure. I'll read this one is an angrier poem.
Cool.
It's called Everything Flesh. I eat every part of you, and then I settle in the skyline. It curves on the horizon with a tremor. Your hand on my shoulder at a bar downtown, a direction, a verb. I want to take liberties, make something new. Your body is a discovery, disappointed, and I'm dizzy with the pull of a wasp sting again and again, frenzied, folded in the kitchen where Pyrex flowers shake their heads and watch. They see me, see you, kiss my mouth. I don't love you. I don't close my eyes. I love myself, and perhaps that is enough of a lie to sustain me, walking shoulder to shoulder with the sun and then the moon and your fucking hand always in mine. Each finger is a morsel, a thing I can suck, and I do. Later you come and we eat deer meat I bought from the market because you can't hunt. Could you cleave me in half if you needed to? Butcher me like I do, flesh everything, bigger than you or me, everything, everything flesh.
Another poem I am very glad that you read, because it was another one that I had flagged as a favorite. I'm so excited to talk about this poem quickly, because it has what I think, Brandy, is my favorite line break in your whole book, in this poem. And that line break is, I love myself and perhaps that is enough, line break, of a lie to sustain me. I thought that was so clever and so well done. I underlined that in red, meaning it was a favorite line. So thank you for that incredible poem and the incredible line break, especially because we already talked about lines. We talked about line breaks kind of and that sort of thing. But we can talk more about them too. what do you think is like makes a good line break? This is a really hard question that seems simple. I've asked this to many people on this show before. What do you think makes a good line break?
This is controversial. I said this once to a poet and they were very like, but I don't think about line breaks as much as I think I should, because I just need to, at least not until very late in the process. I think I have an intuitive way of breaking lines that I haven't been able to figure out how to express. I just know what I like. And I remember what Liz Bichinsky told me what once was like, don't worry about lines right now. Just line breaks right now. Just write. And it'll come. And it did come. I just learned how to, and like, of course I'm always learning, but I learned how to break a line without, break a line in an interesting way some of the time. I honestly have no idea what makes a good line break, besides the fact that it's like, if it can be funny or sad, then I'll do it.
right. And yeah. I think this comes back somewhat to what we were talking about earlier with like the role of poetry, just to connect things. Like I feel like sometimes there doesn't need to be a grand, incredible reason to break a line. And sometimes, as Shazia Hafiz Ramji, I had on for our 50th episode, she told me when I asked her this question that it's a vibe. There's a vibe to Breaking the Lines. And you mentioned intuition, which I'm going to say is the fancy word for a vibe.
Yeah.
So I feel like no matter who I've spoken to, it's hard to get a cut and dry answer on this question. And that's why I love this question and keep coming back to it, is everybody has their own opinion. But I think yours is probably the closest out of anybody I've spoken to my own understanding of line breaks, which is that they can be something that comes in like the second stage of writing, or in the editing stage when you're really starting to chop stuff up. But I find recently, like in the past maybe year when I've been writing, I've just been writing like prose poems or paragraphs. And then if I feel like it afterwards, chopping them up. And the reason I've been doing that is because I spent so much time stressing about where to put line breaks that I wouldn't finish poems that I was writing. Not that you can, you know, there's that whole thing, you can never finish a poem, but I would never finish a draft. Okay. And I feel like we put so much pressure on ourselves. Again, maybe it's just me, other poets, sound off somewhere, let me know. But I feel like there's a lot of pressure on line breaks and on form. Especially recently, as we're moving into this space where people are experimenting more with form and doing wonderful things like you do in your book with form, there can be a lot of pressure that draws me, at least as a poet, out of the poem that I'm writing at times, and I need to come back and do it. I don't know if that makes sense.
That makes sense to me, yes. I feel like I've never had that problem where I've been concerned about line breaks because of advice that Liz Baczynski gave me. I often do the same thing where I'll write prosy poems before I start chopping them up. And I also have experimented with just like chopping my poems up with like at random and seeing what happens, cutting and pasting things. I find that that's really useful for me to find line breaks. But I also, in one of my BFA classes, somebody said something to me, I think, that I never heard before, which is like, how does your line start? And I was like,
oh.
Because they told me, this person told me, you rely a lot on having a verb or a noun, and then you'll use an article or like an and or the, for example, in the way a line, in how a line starts. And I was like, oh, that's true. That is kind of boring. So it's made me think about like how a line starts as well. And I've never considered that before, which is really bizarre. And maybe I don't have this as good an intuition about that sort of thing, or a vibe.
Yeah. No, I think like, I don't know. I won't speak for anybody else, but like, I think I mentioned at the start that this is the 81st episode of this podcast. I've never thought the whole time I've been doing this about the start of a line, like ever.
Yeah, I have been writing poetry for 6 years, but before this like person said this to me, and I'm really appreciative of it. Because in my work now, I try to think about both sides of the line.
Yeah, I have thought so much about, because, okay, I think this is the thing, is like, you mentioned articles, and often I'm using an article at the start of a line because I don't want to end a line on an article. Because I think the rule of thumb for a lot of people is end with a verb or a noun, kind of like you said, or at least my instinct draws me to end with a verb or a noun, because often that's the turn of a unit of language that's so impactful. Mm-hmm. But then what do you do with the article? Like, it doesn't make sense that we've just all decided the start of the line is like the part where we sacrifice the article. So I'm going to be thinking about this for like a very long time, probably longer than we have to record today's episode. So Brandy, I'm going to take a second to think about this. And while I'm thinking about it, I'm wondering if I can get you to give me a question that I can ask my next episode's guest.
Oh my goodness, my question is so bad.
No, I'm so excited for it.
Not intelligent at all. It's literally just like, what's your favorite comfort movie? Because I have a lot of those.
Ooh, okay. I'm glad you have a lot of them. I don't know if you've listened to the show before, but I do this mean thing where I turn the question around. So Brandy, what is your favorite comfort movie?
I love Hot Rod.
Hot Rod. Yo, okay, that's a banger though.
Yeah. It's actually the anniversary. So it came out on this day in 2007. I'm sure this podcast will be out not on the day, but
not today. But I mean, if you want to have like a belated celebration for Hot Rod's birthday, feel free to tag the podcast. I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I movie. Oh my god! And what else? Oh, this is an embarrassing one, but I'll say it anyways. Iron Man.
Really?
Yeah, Iron Man.
Like the first one?
The first one. Since it came out when I was 17, I've watched it every time. I am sad. I don't know why. it's just very comforting to me. I used to be a big MCU fan when I was like a late teen, when it was like new, and now I hate it. I feel like it's taken over movies and it's destroying the industry and all these things, and I think it's on the way out, but hopefully. But I do have a very fond feelings for the first Iron Man.
Wow. You know, it is interesting how we form these, I don't know if it's always nostalgia, but I'm going to say nostalgic connections to things like this that are comfort media, whether it be a movie or something else, a song often, that sort of thing. I'm wondering, Brandy, if you have like a comfort poem or a collection or a poet or anybody that you would turn to in the same moment. If you're like, TV's broken, can't watch Hot Rod, what book are you going to pick up?
Unfortunately, Ariel by Sylvia Plath.
Okay. Yeah, because you do mention that in your book, do you not?
Yeah, I do. I have a poem called Sylvia Plath's Pills, which is probably not right. A nice title. she has a poem called Poppies in October. That was the very first poem I remember reading and loving. I wish I remembered the line, but it's just like it's just so beautiful. And also disturbing, which is.
Yeah. I have to ask too, like, do you see something like nostalgia as playing a significant role in your own writing?
Nostalgia. I don't think nostalgia is the right word. I think more like a yearning. I think poets are very good at yearning. Nostalgia, I took this very weird class that was about at UBC. It was a academic writing course that was about nostalgia. And I had to write this like very weird paper on colonial nostalgia about Downton Abbey. And I find that nostalgia is like, for me, from the research I did for that paper and for like other things in that class, I found that like nostalgia is not a very productive emotion or like feeling. I don't even know if it's an emotion or like a state of mind. I'm disturbed by nostalgia a lot because I feel like it's a static thing.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, I think it serves it, or it can serve its purpose at times. Like when we talk about like a comfort movie, I think you're often like, well, for me anyway, a comfort movie is something that I'll watch and find comfort in. And largely you find that comfort because, you know, you saw it at a time that was particularly formative, or you had a pleasant experience watching that movie or around that film in some way. And so there's that connection to that emotion that I think it serves its purpose every now and then. But I also see what you're saying in terms of like it not being maybe the most productive emotion, or not really, it's not carrying a lot of forward momentum. I mean, you're very much stuck on an idea or thinking through something again. And although there's a lot that you can take from those things, there's also a lot that you can take from, you know, the future and looking forward. So yeah, it's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, I think like the difference between like nostalgia and like this yearning or longing is that like the yearning can be like concerned with the future as well. I don't think that necessarily like longing or yearning is a good place to be all the time either.
Right.
Like we have to live in the present moment or things get wacky.
Yeah, it's true. I understand that. Yeah, I think this is something too that I've been thinking a lot lately about in my own writing, is the role of nostalgia, because I think it's played a very significant role in the way that I write in the past. And perhaps to a point where I sit down to write anything and it comes out this nostalgic piece, or has elements of this sort of thing, which I think there's a difference between using it as, you know, a trademark of your poems and using it as a crutch, which I do feel lately I've been maybe leaning on it a little bit much. I don't know.
Oh, I felt for like when I was rewriting my chapbook, I felt like I was leaning on it as a crutch as well. And that's why I sort of like shifted how I write poetry a little bit.
Mm. So what do you view? Because I know there are also poems from that chapbook that made it into the All Plus Flesh. So what do you view as like the difference, the progression from that chapbook to this collection?
I think so. I think there's 4 poems or 5 poems from my chapbook in this book. Mm-hmm. They're not heavily edited, but they're different. The poems that are in my chapbook now, most of them are at the end of the book. And they've been like sort of like chopped up a little bit. So the line breaks where you want it to break as a reader. It doesn't really break. It doesn't matter where the line breaks are. I just wanted to, make it their like the reader's choice as to how they read the poem. Which I think is how I feel about my chapbook. Like, it's a moment in time, it's a portrait, and I don't identify as that person anymore. And so the chapbook poems in my book are just like experiments in examining that person I was, and letting it go, letting that person go. And like, there's one poem in my book, one of the first poems I ever wrote, called 1999. Of course, it's been heavily edited. It was in my chapbook. It's that poem is after 1992 by Liz Howard. There we go. I talk about her again. That's one of my favorite poems I've ever written. And I'm just so attached to it, even though it's not like technically like formally or like maybe the best poem I've ever written, but it's I have a really big soft spot for it.
I think there are lots of poems like that that make it into collections. I mean, I think too, as a reader, you can sense the significance, especially in a longer collection. Maybe in a chapbook it's a little bit harder, but in a longer collection, like your full length here, you get a real picture of, well, if the author is writing from their perspective, then of the author. And so you can kind of understand why a poem like 1999, which I really liked as well, another one that I believe I had flagged. If not, then I don't know what I'm doing, because I do remember that poem quite well. A poem like that, you can understand why it's included in a collection like this. Like, it doesn't feel out of place, you know? You can understand the significance of it to a collection like this, and actually to your chapbook as well, which I've also read, by the way. And shout out to Rahilla's Ghost, who no longer working but did some fantastic work. They were awesome. So Brandy, we are unfortunately reaching the end of our episode. Before we take off, I wanted to ask if you could read one more poem for us.
For sure. So the poems I chose to read today, I was very lazy and I just chose them all. They're all in sequential order, so in the book. So that's okay though.
Love it.
This poem is called Brandy is Also Alessio. It's about LiveJournal, which is I don't even think it's actually still up. Like, you can still make an
account.
Really? You can still make an account and post every goddamn day if you want to.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a poem about that. Brandy is Also Alessio. I changed my user icon on LiveJournal and girls lose track of my digital face. I am nowhere. Know everything and nothing like the bald face of the moon. I invoke moon because I'm lazy and always have been. It's easy to want to feel celestial when you're looking up at the sky. If only pixelated girls could touch me, feel the curve of my lips. They are Winona Ryder's, and I am nowhere. I invoke nowhere because girls live there. They don't exist in time or space, just float in light and change their faces a swoon on the internet. A girl anonymously accuses me of posting from two accounts. Brandy is also Alicio, she writes, and I feel honored to be mentioned at all. The internet makes me real and unreal. I invoke reality because shouldn't I have something to say about it? I have more to say about avoidance, the pith of experience in the real world. I peel the skin off around my nails and my apartment stinks of cat piss. I am 17 and 22 and 30. I am blue and bleached. I am light, or at least the absence of shadow in my bedroom. I am nowhere. Girls post about their mothers and fathers, post their bruised calves, post indie. They are post-human, and so am I. Profound in our collective, a hive of girls rub themselves raw in real life. Rug burn, and then pictures of rug burn. I post a picture of myself crying, and everything changes. I grow up. Where am I?
Brandy, thank you so much for this poem and for taking the time to chat with me today. I know before we started recording, peek behind the curtain here, Brandy mentioned that this was, I think, one of, if not the first sort of like interview that you're doing for this book. I'm sure there will be many more to come, but I wanted to say that I was very excited to have the chance to chat with you about it.
Thank you.
Yeah, so stoked to talk about this book and to connect. Guys, the book is called The All Plus Flesh. It's out now with House of Anansi. It's by Brandy Bird, who is today's guest. Brandy, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to throw it back to me doing a little outro.
Thank you.
So there you are. That was me chatting with Brandy Bird. Brandy, thank you for your time. I gave a little bit of a long-winded backstory at the start of the episode, but I just, it's so cool to see a writer who you know is going to write some fantastic poems, and already had at that point, and then see them go from a chapbook to a full length and now on to probably even bigger, better things too. I mean, it's just so cool. And so to have a chance to sit down with Brandy and talk to them about their work was very cool. I love this book and I hope that you enjoyed the readings, and I hope you'll check the full book out too. There's a link below this episode in the description to check it out. Not too much housekeeping other than to say I should be back next month. I say that mostly to hold myself accountable. I hope I'm back next month with another episode. But if I'm not, you can follow me, and I'm still doing poetic stuff out there. I'm reading and I'm posting about it these days. So you can follow me on Twitter. No, you can't. Wait, yes, you can. You can follow me on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at the Andrew French. It's now known as X, and I am likely to be an X account of X very soon. But I'll still be posting this podcast there. So at PageFrightPod on Instagram is where you can check out all the things that we're doing, get updated about the new episodes. You can also follow and subscribe to the podcast. You can leave reviews. That's really helpful because it means that people who don't know this show will check it out. And by doing that, they hear the work of poets who are being interviewed on the show. And that ultimately is the whole point of what's going on here. So that would be fantastic if you left a review. Regardless, follow on Instagram at It's Andrew French. My name is Andrew French. And this, of course, this has been Page Fright.